The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, today, in the mail, I received the kind of little program, maybe, that you get sometimes handed out at a memorial service. And it was for a man who used to come to IMC, who died about a year ago, a little less than a year ago. And last July, there was a memorial service for him, or something like that. They apparently, it consisted of taking a boat out into the, from the Santa Cruz Harbor to cast his ashes. So they had a little program, including instructions to meet afterwards for pizza at some pizza place. Though some of you, I don't know if some of you knew Frank Ryerson, came here from on and off for many years, lovely man. And I didn't go to this memorial service. I don't know if I even knew about it, but I finally got the program today. And there's a poem that he wrote. And there's a poem by the Japanese poet Basho. So I think if you read Basho's poem first, maybe his poem will stand out a little bit more and highlight. So this Japanese poet writes, "Even in Kyoto, hearing the gulls cry, I long for Kyoto." So he's right there. He has what he wants, but he still wants it. So this wanting thing, that's one of the things that we're contending with when we do this practice, is that come to terms, understand the nature of our wanting. And sometimes it's absurd. Maybe not your wanting. Maybe your wanting is always serious and of great important consequence. But it does happen from time to time that it's even possible to kind of be amused by one's wanting, by the incessant nature of it. It's possible sometimes to cry in grief at the incessant nature of it. But it's also possible to wake up, to become free. So this is a poem by Frank, and it's titled, "Nothing is Enough." Nothing is enough. Or, everything is not enough. I have a hunger beyond any object it chooses. A hunger never still nor satisfied, only occupied for moments. The hunger is and is not me. I can't outrun it. And if I feed it, it wants more. Mostly it wants something else. A wise person said, stop. Hold still for a bit. And you will be used eventually. You will become the instrument of what needs to be said. You might be lucky this way, become nothing. Then nothing is enough. Wouldn't it be nice if you came to the point where nothing is enough means you're always thirsting and you can never get enough, to nothing is enough because you don't need anything or don't want anything, just having nothing is enough. My father-in-law didn't want anything. And so one of his daughters-in-law gave him for his birthday once a big box. And I think he was a little bit disturbed that he was going to get this present that he didn't want. And so he opened it, and inside was another box. He opened it, inside was another box. He went in and in, and the innermost box had a card. And I think it was a Buddhist monk, the cover, who was opening a box that had nothing inside. And it said, and he's very happy, this Buddhist monk said, "Just what I wanted." Nothing, you know. So that card my father-in-law kept, and it was for years, he kept it in the kitchen wall. So he finally got something he kind of wanted, I guess. So nothing is enough. Wouldn't that be good news, if you could say that to me? And so this, you know, there is a kind of nature of wanting sometimes where you can never get enough. And I certainly have had that experience of having my desire fulfilled and seeing in the next moment I'm looking and searching for the next thing. I've also had the experience of in the middle of getting some particular desire fulfilled, because I'm in the, you know, it's not just a momentary taste of something, but it, you know, it's going on. And while I'm finally I'm in the situation I've been dreaming about for a long time, I finally orchestrated it. In the middle of being it, I'm thinking about wanting something different, the next thing or something else. And it's possible to finally get what you want and then miss it because you're preoccupied with the next wanting. And then there's a way in which too much wanting is a self-alienating. The wanting kind of usually looks beyond itself or look beyond us. We want something. And there's a way sometimes where you can feel that we lose a connection with ourselves. Maybe we're very connected to part of ourselves, the desire part. And it can feel compulsive, it can feel driven, it can feel insistent, it has a lot of authority. And if our sense of self is tied to that desire, it can feel that this is essential, that this is who I am and I deserve it. I once went to, many, many years ago, about 20 years ago or so, I went to buy a car at a car dealership, you know, try them out. And I was driving around with a salesperson sitting in the passenger seat. And he proceeded to tell me that I deserved to have an air conditioner, which I wasn't interested in having, but I deserved it, so... So if I deserve my desires, boy, it becomes really important to have them. And it's nice that Frank in his poem says, "The hunger is not me." It's an interesting kind of, you know, to see both perspectives. And how do we see both perspectives? I don't know what he means, but what... So the hunger, the desire, the craving, it is me in the sense that my desire is not yours. My desire is not your problem. I take responsibility. It's happening here and this being here. It's not anywhere else. So in a certain way, it is mine to be responsible for, to be caring for, to be careful with. And then the hunger is also not mine, not me. I don't have to be defined by it. It doesn't represent who I essentially am. And some of these desires, you know, kind of, you know, that's one of the advantages of mindfulness. If you can be still and quiet and mindful, and you're sitting there maybe following your breath, minding your own business, and suddenly some nice desire thought just bubbles up. Where'd that come from? I didn't will it. I didn't want it. I didn't want to want. I wasn't planning it. I didn't engineer it. I didn't go through a list of all the desires and say, I'm not going to have that one. It's there it is. And it's possible to watch certain thoughts, certain ideas and desires simply arise and not feel any hook, any identification with it. It's just phenomena coming and going. It's just a thought that arises, just a desire, it's an impulse that arises. And nothing more, nothing less. And there's no tendency to, as I said, define oneself by it, think it's me, feel that somehow it has inherent value or compulsion or truthfulness because it's me, because, you know, if I identify with my desires, and then I've grown up in a world where, you know, the self deserves certain things, self needs certain things, we only can be happy if the self has certain things. And so they're all kind of doing something with this self-concept that we've been inherited or learned or acquired. And if it's not tied to any of the self-concepts and the values around self, so the, you know, the learned ideas around what it means to have a self and all this, then the desire arises and you can kind of like watch it go. Doesn't stick. You don't get hooked into it. It becomes just a phenomena of nature. It's like the wind picks up and leaves get blown across the street and the wind dies down, the leaves settle down. Oh, look at that. The leaves are not me. I don't identify with it. They're just phenomena. So it's remarkable to be able to watch some of the activities of the mind arise as just phenomena that has no, in a certain kind of way, no bearing on me, no relationship to me, no, just kind of like just stuff. I'm not defined by it. So both have their value, both perspectives. This is me, this is not me. And one of the ways to, you know, is to take responsibility for the ways we get hooked, the way we get pushed around, the way that desires grab us by the nose and, you know, or the way we believe them, the way that we invest in them. And then take responsibility for that. Say, you know, I don't have to do that. I don't have to keep chasing these desires. There's another way. And the way of this poem, a wise person said, stop. Hold still for a bit. I love the idea to hold still for a bit. That seems realistic. Just stop and be done with it. Stop and hold still for a long time. That's problematic too. That people who hold themselves tight or still and don't try to act or try to just... Sometimes that represents a very strong desire that's gotten in the way. But just for a bit. So I don't know what that means for you, but just for a bit. Enough to see what's going on and enough to make a pause in some of the incessant desires that are operating in order to be able to listen and hear something different. What else wants to happen? What can't happen if we're spinning around in our desires? And I remember many years ago, it's a story I've told maybe often enough, but I used to love going into bookstores, and I would. But I noticed after a while that whenever I left the bookstore, I was exhausted, and I thought that's strange. So at some point, I started paying attention to what I did in the bookstores, and mostly what I did was, I want that book, I want that book, I want that book, I want that book, and it was just like all this desire. And it was like, you know, lots of titles that I wanted. I didn't have any money, but that didn't stop me from wanting. And it was the wanting that was tiring. But the reason I tell you the story is for this point, while I was doing it, I didn't feel the cost of that wanting. I didn't see how it was wearing me out. And And so there's sometimes if we get too caught up in the what we want too much, as I said earlier, it's alienating. We lose a connection with ourselves. We don't really see what's happening and what's driving us. So to stop long enough to see, but also to stop long enough to be able to hear what else wants to arise, what else is going on. And when we do this practice, at some point in the practice, we come to a junction. We come to a turning point, or I like to think of it the crest of the mountain, like we're walking up the mountain. It's a lot of work, and it's like maybe if you're biking. You're biking up the mountain. It's a lot of work to bike up the mountain. When you get to the top and the road goes down the other side, then you can just coast. It's just like easy. So there comes a turning point in this practice where the practice becomes easier, more natural. Where you can, at some point from doing the practice, that you can feel the momentum is towards freedom. The momentum is towards not clinging, not desiring, and it feels really good. So the example is that, you know, if I hold my hand in a fist really tight, and I've really done it so long that it's kind of like, you know, got a little bit frozen in my hand, or I'm holding onto something in that fist, I'm gripped onto something that seems so important to have that. There's a few lessons from learning to look at our clinging. But one is, I might at some point, you know, think, you know, maybe I should do this practice, maybe I should let go. So initially it takes a lot of work to begin loosening up the fingers. And it's a work, and sometimes it actually hurts, and you have to push against the way it's been frozen and in there. And it's a lot of work to kind of get them, but you kind of believe in it, the value. At some point, the hand is opened up big enough, relaxed enough, that the next moments of opening and relaxing the hand feel so good. It feels like this is the right way to go. This is actually the better thing to do. Not only that, but it kind of feels like, almost if you're anthropocentric about it, which I guess you're allowed to do for your hand, it's like the hand wants to be released. That's the desire of the hand, is to not be so clinging. Or that's where there's less work. It's freer, it's more easy to do that. But it takes a while to get to that junction or that point where it becomes easier to let go, easier to be free than it is to cling and to want. So at some point, this idea of stop, be still for a bit, is to start making space and time to listen to something deeper that wants to happen. And one of the things that might happen is that you feel like the movement towards the freedom from desire, from clinging, is innate within us. That's the direction the heart wants to go. And the other thing that we might discover is that how much we don't want to let go, because we feel we're going to, you know, to let go of things, to let go of the holding and clinging to things, is to lose something, we think. But what I'd like to propose, that if you're clinging to something, you've already lost a lot. There was loss in doing that. Because if you're clinging, for example, to something really tight, like I'm clinging to this striker holding on, the striker might be, you know, maybe it's the best striker in the world, and it's worthwhile clinging to, and I'm going to, you know, have it, and, you know, my status as a Dharma teacher depends a lot on the quality of striker that I have up here, and it's like I'm not going to lose it, all these wonderful things. But what I've lost in clinging to this is I've lost an open hand that's full of potential, full of possibilities. This open hand is soft, it's sensitive, it can feel things, it can touch things, if the fingers are available to do all kinds of work. I've lost a lot in order to cling. So yes, sometimes in clinging we lose certain things, but I think that to pay careful attention, we discover we actually gain more than we lose. At least when it's done well, we gain a sensitivity, we gain potential to respond and to interact with the world in a different way. And we get potential to let some kind of motivation, some kind of movement of to arise within us that's deep, comes from a deeper place maybe, or a freer place than what comes from when we're caught in desire, when we're caught in identification, when we're trying to be something, when we want to be something or want to not be something, always wanting. And Frank's poem kind of points to this. A wise person said, stop, hold still for a bit, and you will be used eventually. That's kind of interesting. Be used, you'll be used. You'll have a place, you'll have a purpose, you'll have some, the world will need you for something. You know, it's, there's very few mature Buddhist practitioners that I know who become couch potatoes. So you don't have to worry about that. Enlightened couch potatoes. You will be used eventually. You will become the instrument of what needs to be said. You will become the instrument of what needs to be said. So what does that mean if you become the instrument rather than the instigator? The instrument rather than the person who's in charge and the person who will take credit, infinite credit. Look at me, you know, I said the wise, wonderful things. You become the instrument for what needs to be said. And this is, you know, one of the things that can happen. It's a little bit hard for the psyche to trust and believe that if we let go of clinging, if we let go of the incessant pull and drive for desire and wanting, and oddly enough, sometimes it's even appropriate, at least temporarily or in a wise way, to let go of appropriate things, healthy things. I've known people who, the reason they cling is because what they're clinging to is actually a fine thing. In and of itself, it's a fine thing to cling to. Like eating. Eating is a fine thing to do. I want you to eat. It's good to eat. But I had an eating disorder for a while where I couldn't stop eating. And I was clinging to the very thing which was healthy to do. Just, you know, wanting more and more and more. And so sometimes you want to even this thing, but stop for a bit is really healthy so we can listen and hear something deeper. So like, for example, retreats are a good place where all kinds of things which might be appropriate in everyday life, we have a chance to stop there. So, for example, you know, socializing and having friends and doing things with things, people, that could be a nice thing to do. And you might have a healthy desire for that. But to stop that, like for a 7-day retreat, to not be involved in the social life in the usual way, might allow you to stop and pause to hear some deeper movement inside, a deeper desire, a deeper thing that wants to be expressed or to be lived. So this idea of this meditation some kind of way in our life to stop for a bit so we can hear something differently. So something else besides the ego or the usual kind of place where we're kind of caught up in self-definition and proving ourselves or apologizing for ourselves has a chance. So this is... Then he ends, you might be lucky this way, become nothing. Then nothing is enough. And I remember having Frank came to visit me here after he was sick, and we sat on the porch, and he told me he'd never been happier in his life. Though he knew he was going to be dying. And he was. He was really happy. So maybe he knew something about nothing. And maybe you can learn something about nothing. Wouldn't that be something? But don't make it into something. Let it, keep it as a nothing. So you don't claim it for yourself. So you don't build a self from it. Just nothing. And maybe you can be happy. And maybe your desires will take a very different quality. There's no human life without desires. But the quality, the characteristics of those desires will be very different once you have a new relationship to them, a new relationship to how it flows out of you. Nothing is enough, or everything is not enough. I have a hunger beyond any object it chooses, a hunger never still nor satisfied, only occupied for moments. The hunger is and is not me. I can't outrun it, and if I feed it, it wants more. Mostly it wants something else. A wise person said, stop. Hold still for a bit, and you'll be used eventually. You will become the instrument of what needs to be said. You might be lucky this way. Become nothing. Then nothing is enough. So thank you all. And...